Neve Solicitors are proud to sponsor The Parent Show. The friendly team at Neve's includes specialists who can guide you through all the legal ups and downs of family life. Visit nevesolicitors.co.uk. Neve Solicitors, your complete legal solution.
A very warm welcome to The Parents Show on Radio Verulam 92.6 FM. I'm Lydia Elcoury.
And I'm Shirley Hayman. Welcome. Thanks for tuning in again. And tonight our show is going to be all about our children going out into the world and doing things all by themselves.
And us actually letting them go.
Yeah, trying to let them go.
Exactly.
So we've done something different this week. We went out into St Albans Town and we met with some local mums and we want to thank them for their time. And they were called Claire, Debbie and Kim. And we sat round a table and we had a good old chin wag and we tried to find out, you know, what are the issues for mums of children ranging from sort of primary school all the way up to children that have actually left home. How do we let go? What things upset us? Can we advise one another? It seems to be a topic that comes up again and again on the mum's Facebook page around here in St Albans. So that's what we're going to be talking about tonight. And we've got other guests on as well who are going to help us explore that subject.
Okay. Well, welcome to our discussion in St Albans about letting go. We've got lovely mums here sitting around the table. Would you like to introduce yourselves, ladies?
I'm Kim. I've got a 15-year-old son.
Hi, I'm Debbie. I have a 25, 23 and 13-year-old.
And I'm Claire. I've got two girls. They're 15 and 18.
Lovely. Now, the topic of discussion this evening, Shirley, would you like to explain what it is?
Yeah, thanks, Kathy. We're thinking about letting go. You know, when's the right time to let your children do things for the first time? Things like going to festivals, having a phone, drinking, you know, having a boyfriend come home, that kind of thing. So we're really keen to hear what the St Albans mums think about it, especially because some of them have done it already and some of us are actually going through this process now. So we thought we'd start with primary school, yeah?
Yeah, so we've got the whole age range here. We've got parents of people aged from 5 up to 25. So if we sort of start at when these kind of pressures to let go begin, what would you say the first... Debbie, the first time you sort of experienced, oh, I might have to actually, you know, let go of the reins a little bit.
With my current youngest child, I think it was really around the mobile phone issue. That was a big one in primary school. Some people had them, and he was very good at making his case for why he should be able to have one as well, and particularly when it gets to transition, I'm going to be walking home on my own, you want me to walk home, and for me to do that safely, they're good at coming up with good reasons.
And I think that's a common excuse, if you like, that they say, oh, I need to ring you from the bus, and then suddenly within 5 months they've got an iPhone. You know, what do we sort of think about the general accessibility of phones for primary age children?
It's interesting you say that, though. Within probably 2 months of them having a phone, the importance of actually ringing us from the bus, they won't answer the phone when we ring them.
Yeah, that's
the thing.
You can never get through
to them. Yeah, yeah. So the importance of, so actually they're using their phone in a completely different way, we know.
Than they're asking permission for.
Yes.
Exactly, yeah. It's all assumed
that's
just
a marketing
ploy.
You know, this is why they persuade you by telling you all the needs it's going to be in you. That's just marketing. That's just clever marketing. And like you say, within a very short space of time, you can't get them to ring, to answer their phone. But I found a way around that was I had such a complete meltdown with my son when I did get hold of him, and I took his phone away. And I said, the only purpose for you to have this phone is so that I can contact you and you can contact me. There's no point you having it if you don't answer.
Did that do the trick?
Well, yes, because I was really furious. I was very worried. I can't remember now what the situation was, but I couldn't get hold of him when I needed to. And for me to spend that sort of money on a phone, what is the point?
So who thinks it's okay to buy a 10-year-old, say, a phone at the beginning of their secondary career?
I think you'd struggle not to.
Yeah.
It would be peer pressure and you'd have to be really, really strong not to, but I think it would be slightly unfair on the children not to, because they'd be the only ones and they'd lose out on communicating with their friends.
And this is a big, massive topic, is peer pressure, isn't it? Mm. You know, but all my friends have one. I mean, to a certain extent, shouldn't we parents be more resilient to that?
Do we not bow to it as well, though?
But why?
We're asking other parents' advice. We're going on St. Albans Bund Facebook page saying, what should I do about this? What should I do about this? And if the majority are saying, that's okay, then you kind of think, well, okay, I'll do that.
But do you feel in that sort of arena where you're asking permission, perhaps on social media, you know, do we not feel it's more important to stick to your guns? When do you stick to your guns about a particular issue?
Well, I think if you're talking about sticking to your guns, you can do that if you don't have a phone, or if you limit yourself to a phone that only receives incoming and makes outgoing calls. The reality is most of us don't. Most of us have computers, handheld computers, and also it is a truth that actually it's very convenient for me to ring him and say, actually, I'm still working, I'm not going to be home for half an hour. So you know, when he did his whole marketing ploy, it wasn't unfounded. It is good to be able to contact them.
I want to try, on the subject of phones and computers, so the internet, I want to try to limit get the internet turned off by speaking to my internet provider. Can you turn it off at a certain point? Is there anything I can do? Is there a program I can download? There didn't seem to be anything, nothing to for me to have any reassurance that I knew there would be no internet connection after 9 o'clock at night or whatever it was for little kids. I think it's better now, but when my two, there just didn't seem to be anything. I couldn't stop them accessing the internet apart from taking it away.
I used to take it away before my son went to bed at night, because if not, he would lay in bed till 10, 11, 12 o'clock at night on Facebook, on Instant Messenger. You know, so for me it was like, you go to bed at 9 o'clock, I take your phone off you at 9 o'clock. I mean, obviously he was younger, but now, I mean, you know, he has got that trust thing now.
But I just think the internet companies should be supporting parents and giving them the option to do that. Probably the kids would know how to take back on again. But
in a way, those companies should be facilitating us letting go, because letting go now isn't the same as letting go in 1973. Yeah. These children's phones are total technological worlds that open them up to. So I think from what you're saying, it's not just a phone, is it?
It's a mini computer, which opens a world of absolute horror, really. You know, the links on certain social networking sites that take them to pornography, to violent scenes. You know, yesterday I was subjected to seeing premature dead babies on a certain social network, and I don't want to see that, and I certainly don't want children to see that. So it is opening up a big can of worms, I think.
And it's not just what they can access, but it's what they do with the phone themselves. So sending images that they think are funny or they think are private and not going to be shared, and then they find the whole school within moments has received that same piece of information or that image.
And then that's when bullying comes in, because that person is going to be bullied because you can see their face. That's when you have children, unfortunately, committing suicide, because the bullying gets so horrific through these images that have been sent. Children just don't realise what they're doing when they send pictures of themselves.
So when you're considering letting go, buying them a phone or letting them go and do particular things, are the factors that you're considering things to do with the technological capability of the phone, what their friends think? What are the things that help you make up your mind whether or not to give them accessibility to those sorts of things?
Okay, to answer this slightly differently, for me anyway, one of the things I was forced to consider was that at primary school, we were the parent. Once my child went to secondary school, the school, and I think most schools do this, were very keen to insist to the parents and the children that your child is now a young adult and they must be mindful and look after themselves, and we expect them to be able to do this, this and this. And it sort of feeds into that whole, well, I'm grown up now, Mum, or I'm growing up and I need these things. And so I think we get messages as parents that also push us into decisions that we might not have done.
Yeah, that's very interesting that you're given this message. Stay away, they're independent now, they can survive, they have to learn to survive without you. And then the sort of requests come for a phone and requests to go to parties. And Kim, you mentioned Facebook there. Now, we know that there's advice that Facebook gives as to, for example, when children should go on Facebook. Is that something you've ignored, or do you let your child go on it from an earlier age? I think it's 12 that Facebook... 13.
I think my son was a bit younger than that age, but I did have the password to his Facebook, and I did constantly, when he first went on there, check his messages, check his friends, and if I didn't know one of his friends, I'm like, who is this? And, you know, you have to sort of cross-question them a little bit, because there are obviously groomers that are pretending to be pretty 17-year-old girls and sort of, like, flirting with these young boys that are really just trying to groom them. So you have to, I mean, I said to him, if I don't have your password, you don't have Facebook. So for me, he trusted me. And now I get to the stage where I go, Mum, I've had this really weird message and somebody sent me this, or I've had a friend request. And he was like, shall I just ignore it? I'm like, just ignore it. But then I think because we're open with each other, that's why he doesn't mind coming to me now and discussing things like, you know, the dangers on Facebook and grooming and stuff like that.
So you're sort of reliant on that open, trusting conversation between you. So a lot relies upon that basic relationship. Would you agree, Debbie?
Yeah, I do. There were a couple of points, though, that I wanted... When you were talking, Kim, it made me think... First of all, my kids wouldn't be on Facebook because anywhere where I am, they don't want to be. So when it comes to social media, we are way behind. So if we're on it, they're not going to be on it for too long. Or maybe that's just in my family, I don't know. But if I can stalk them, they're not there. The other thing is I've had a different experience, and it's not to say that there aren't all those dangers out there and that we shouldn't be incredibly vigilant, but I personally have been on the receiving end on several occasions where I've had parents contact me because my son's contacted them, or I have somehow sent a message, and they've driven themselves mad worrying that I'm a stalker, or my son's a potential stalker or groomer. And I have felt very sad initially and angry that, why do you react that way? My son is a friend of your child's and he's just sent them a message. So, yeah, I'm not disagreeing with what you were saying in any way, but it's just another experience that I've had that we sometimes get very worried and we think any contact, if we don't know the child, must be problematic. At least that's been my experience. I have had very irate parents.
I think what you're alluding to is the difficulty of parents these days they're trying to work out how friendships are formed. So, and often they'll be formed online,
they'll
be formed in school. They're trying to keep tabs on who their children's friends are. Are they really friends on Facebook? You know, you don't know, so you're trying to sort of...
I think kids now, if they know somebody, they instantly they go, oh yeah, my friend. And I'm what's your friend's name? Or where do they... Oh, I don't know. And I'm like, well, they're not your friends. It's sort of like trying to explain to them, just because you know somebody and you speak to them on Facebook or Xbox or something like that, does not make that person your friend because he's on your friends list.
Mm-hmm. But I think that's this is their view now, that they've got hundreds of friends, whereas actually they've probably got less than perhaps we had when we were out and about making friends.
You know, I think now it's a big race, isn't it, to get as many friends on Facebook as you can possibly get, because I've got 500 friends and someone else going, oh, I've got 600. So you're constantly trying to add just people that you might have just had a glimpse of, or you might have somebody else's
friend.
People aren't your friends and you don't know nothing about these people. So, you know, there is that danger of, you know, who is actually on your children's Facebook?
I suppose it's instilling in them the confidence to actually say, well, do you know what? You don't have to have 600 friends. They're not. You can't have 600 people that you know
impossible.
You know, it is impossible, isn't it? And if you can instill that in them and they understand that, then that's their defence. They don't have to have, or they don't have to worry about how many comments they get or how many likes they get or whatever it is on each post them.
And I think Kim made a good point, didn't she, about, you know, taking the phone away at 9 o'clock at night, setting the boundaries before that phone's even out of the box and given to the child. Mm-hmm. Actually, yeah,
definitely.
You know, because once they've got into bad habits, it's much harder then, isn't it, to change it?
Really hard.
So,
and actually, we've not talked at all about the aspect of radiation and Wi-Fi.
No.
And I know some parents who will not allow their child to have a phone because they are concerned, and there is reasonable amounts of research that suggests they're not actually that clever for us, especially with the developing brain. So there are many reasons that people have for not using them.
That was partly why I was keen to turn the internet off, so you had no Wi-Fi when everybody's in bed next to the office where the Wi-Fi is coming in, and you know. But there doesn't seem to be, you know, turn it off at the mains.
Yeah.
They don't. That doesn't last long. They got wise to that.
Or just keep changing the password on the Wi-Fi.
Yes,
so
that's a really good idea.
My friend used to do that quite a lot. She'd change the password if someone was playing up, and so he couldn't use his Facebook, his Xbox, his PlayStation. It was change the password every 2 days. So then if he was being naughty, it's like, you can't go on it because you don't know the password. You know, which is quite good. So then you've got access, but your children haven't.
Yeah.
Do you think, all of you, that saying no to our children is a difficult thing in general? Are we afraid of the comeback? Are we afraid of the confrontation? You know, how can that conversation take place about these issues? You know, I think many parents are afraid of the big confrontation, or they might, you know, not quite sure or have the confidence themselves to say, no, you're not going on Facebook until you're whatever, or, you know. But what do you think about that? Does it require parents' confidence, a lot of confidence, to say no?
I think it requires confidence and knowledge of that particular medium. If they understand Facebook or they understand Instagram or whatever else it is, it's easier then to say, these are the reasons why I don't think you should be using it, or these are the reasons why I'm going to limit it, these are the reasons why I use it in this way. But it's hard for us to keep up. As we get older, they know more than we do, and that's why when it becomes difficult and different, I suppose.
So it's about our knowledge.
Our knowledge is nowhere near as
you happen to know how Facebook works. You know, you're trying to outwit, you know, to keep up, to protect them.
Yeah. I guess one strategy might be to say, these are my concerns, so I need you to be aware of why I'm saying no now. And we can have a conversation, and if you can help address those fears, then we can have a reasonable discussion about this. I'm not saying yes, I'm just saying, these are my fears, we can have a discussion about it, and if they're still there at the end of the conversation, then my answer is still no. But it might be our fears are ungrounded, and it might be that their request is quite reasonable. Yeah. But our fears could be irrational, not necessarily, but it's
not a lovely point.
I think a lot of it is how streetwise your child is as well, because some children have absolutely got no sense whatsoever, and they shouldn't even be allowed out of the house on their own, let alone let loose on a computer. But I think if they're quite streetwise and you speak to them at, like an adult, more than like a child, if you keep going no and looking down on them. But I think this is where my relationship with Sam is, because I look at him as an equal to me when we're having a discussion. He's got more respect for me because I am treating him like an adult. I give him my reasons, and then he'll think about it and he'll come back at me.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like, I'm not going to go no. I'm going to go, these are my concerns. I don't particularly want you doing this and that. And then he'll go, well, actually, Mum, you know, I'm not stupid. I do know the dangers of what's on the internet. And I think that's where... I think all children are different. Some 10-year-olds are fine on an internet, but then some 14-year-olds shouldn't be on it. I think all children are different at their ages.
Yeah.
So what are the particular... Moving on to things like parties, festivals, you know, external sort of social events that they might want to go to, what are the things that we're afraid of and anticipate that might happen to them guiding our decisions as to whether they let... You know, there's so many things to worry about. They might get knocked down on the way to the festival. They might get lost. They might get abducted. You know, raped, murdered, have drugs offered to them. You know, where do the worries begin and end? What is it that we can rely on? How do you make a decision, say, for example, I mean, you've got older children, Debbie, that they go to a festival or not. At what age is it appropriate to do that?
Well, I don't feel as qualified to talk about this, actually, because my eldest didn't, my youngest didn't go to a festival, but he went to they went to Newquay, which was all the thing at the time. It was when you finished your GCSEs, you headed down there, and it was absolutely something I didn't want. He did go. I can't quite remember how that all happened, but I wasn't personally overwhelmed, but I was overtaken by the momentum of this thing.
Everybody's going.
Was going.
Yeah.
And there was no way he wasn't. What I found particularly challenging was the parents who dropped their kids off at the bus with a crate of beer. And I just thought, you have to be kidding me. So you are condoning the drinking that is going to go on. The place has a reputation, and I found it very, very difficult. Now, my son did go, and he came back, and he said it was hideous, and he saw and, you know, was witness to fights and disgusting behaviour, and he would never go again. But he did go, and I did have to relinquish that hold over him and that protection. And I think a lot of it is fear of the unknown, and that big sort of issue you make for yourself of all the what ifs. But actually, I think the fears for me were the things I did know, which were kids have no idea or appreciation for alcohol. They have no idea what to do when somebody is drunk. For the most part, if a kid's passed out, they're a lightweight. They're not thinking alcohol poisoning. They're not thinking recovery position in case they choke on their vomit. So those are knowns, aren't they? Those are things we do worry about.
Fantastic. So thank you very much to the local moms, Claire, Debbie and Kim, who gave us a fantastic chat just there about letting go and some very interesting ideas, turning off the Wi-Fi so your children can't surf at night, changing the password so they can't, and you know, letting children go off on school visits that you really just didn't want them to do in the first place.
And Lydia, you probably heard, you know, we had so many topics we wanted to cover, and yet actually that phone one, you know, the phone one was really very, very dear to their hearts, I think, in all those mums' cases. So we've got more of the interview that maybe we can play at a later stage, because we go on to talk about other subjects. But yeah, as Lydia said, thank you very much to the mums that took part in that conversation. Now, continuing the theme this evening of letting go, when should we, how soon is too soon? We're joined, hopefully, on the phone by Dr. Amanda Gummer, psychologist. Are you there, Amanda?
Yeah, good evening.
Good evening. Thanks for joining us on The Parents Show.
You're welcome.
Now, you've been listening to that discussion that we had in St. Albans a couple of evenings ago. Amanda, lots of worries have come out of that. You know, they're worried about mobile phones. You've heard yourself, children attending festivals, underage drinking, social media use. What's your sort of immediate response to what you've heard?
It's a minefield, isn't it? I think it's so hard for parents, because there is so much stuff coming and the rate of change is escalated, so you just feel like you've got a handle on one thing and then they've grown into the next phase and you face a whole new set of challenges and things you don't understand, and you're supposed to know what the right thing to do is. I mean, my eldest daughter always tells me, you know, she goes, you're a psychologist, you should know what I'm doing. I'm like, yeah, it's the first time I've been a parent. I've not done this one before. Yeah. And it's very hard for parents. I think we do give ourselves really high standards, and there's a lot of, because of a lot of all this stuff in the media and there's an information overload, you feel like you should be on top of it all, but you can drown in all the advice and all the information, all the research about what the best thing to do for your children is.
But again, in that discussion, it's very clear we're facing a tidal wave of pressure from, you know, they have their own peer pressure to contend with in school. And it's very difficult, as one of the mums said, you know, when everybody's going to the party in Newquay, it's very hard to stop your child attending.
It is really hard, and I think that's one of those things. If you have always let your kids go along with the crowd and they've given into the kind of peer pressure from right from the word go, you can't at 16 or 17 suddenly go, eh, no, you can't do it.
Right.
Whereas I think the important thing there is to teach them from a very early age that you don't need to follow the crowd, you don't need to be one of the popular kids, you don't need to fit in. It's about figuring what you like and helping children develop their own sense of identity from as early as sort of 6, 7. They can start to understand why they're different, you know, and be it one kid likes Man U and the other kid likes Liverpool, or one person likes football and the other one likes rugby, or whatever it happens to be, that it's okay to be different and it's okay to not have to follow the crowd. I think that's one of the best gifts we can give our kids.
And I think there's great anxiety when children transition from primary into secondary. And I thought it was a very interesting point made that suddenly the schools perhaps might be delivering a message like, you know, these children need to walk to school on their own, they have to walk independently around the school and, you know, attend different classrooms, and they're going to be a little bit more grown up, and the parents may sort of fade into the background a little bit. What's your sort of advice on parents whose children might be just about to go to secondary school or in the early days of secondary school, how they sort of navigate that?
Yeah, I think the idea of letting go gradually is really important, and children are often, certainly around that age, sort of 9, 10, 11, 12, they are craving some control and some independence and sort of autonomy over their life. And it's really good for parents to be able to sort of start giving them that trust, to be able to let them do a little bit more on their own, maybe walk down to the shop, maybe go to the park with their friends, maybe, you know, just, but it's something that the children learn is an earned, you know, freedom, and it's based on trust, and they have to be back when they say they're going to be back, and they have to understand the, you know, the dangers, and that they have to understand what the social etiquette is about, you know, how to, even silly things like making sure you can cross the road safely, because the parents need to feel that the kids are able to be trusted, to be safe, and letting that happen gradually from as young as sort of 7 or 8, helps the kids make that transition to secondary school not seem such a big deal, because they've started to get those independent. And it's like with all this sort of the risk assessment and the cotton wool kids generation, you can't get to 18 and suddenly expect children or young adults now to understand how to monitor their own alcohol intake or drive a car safely if they haven't had that kind of gradual learning of how to do risk assessments and how to be responsible and independent. It doesn't happen overnight. It's got to start from a really early age.
I mean, I think that's a brilliant message, because I think a lot of parents with younger children think, oh, I've got that all ahead of me when they enter teenage years, when actually, as you say, this is something to embed into an, you know, how you assess risk is something a 5-year-old can begin with, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And even younger, because, I mean, little kids, when they're learning, you know, they're holding your hand and they're jumping off the bottom step, they know whether they can jump off the bottom step or the second step. And if they jump off the second step and they fall a bit and they, you know, that's, isn't it much better that they learn that way than waiting till they're 10 and thinking they can jump off the top step and breaking the neck? You know, it's that kind of make it, give them the opportunity to learn when the consequences aren't severe.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
You've got kids that are growing up now who have no sense of danger. They think they're invincible. That's why you're getting increased numbers of young adults coming to harm in cars and with drugs and alcohol and all that sort of stuff, because they've never really been given that opportunity to learn.
So potentially wrapped up in cotton wool, get to university and then don't
and
know how to manage any of those risks.
Yeah.
Amanda, a bit controversial, but many parents think it might be okay to let their child taste alcohol at an earlier age, before 18, or it might be cigarette, anything, to sort of, they think that a little taster might put them off. What's your general view about that approach?
There's lots of different reasons behind the different viewpoints. I can only explain why I have mine, and mine is that if you forbid stuff, it becomes so much more appealing. And the best thing that I think my parents ever did for me was to say, at some point you may want to try alcohol, you might want to try getting drunk, you might want to try smoking, whatever. If you do, you're likely to be quite poorly. So if you want to do it at home so that we can look after you. And that took away any forbidden pleasure, you know, any kind of desire for me to do it as a rebellion, and it just lost its appeal. And I think of all, you know, lots of things that my parents did that I carry on with my kids, and, you know, I was very lucky. But that is one of the best things I think they did for me. And I think getting rid of the forbidden nature, accepting that kids will experiment with all this sort of stuff, because most of us did at some point as well, but helping them do it in a... I think the most important thing is that they communicate and they can talk to you about it, because then you can help them. The minute they stop talking to you about it and it goes underground, you have no control over it.
Okay.
So even if you have limited control and you're not quite comfortable with some of the stuff they're doing, the fact that they're talking to you and the fact that they're open about it has to be better than the alternative.
Now, within that sort of open, communicative, you know, relationship with your child, is it appropriate, is it sensible to share with them the time you were 17 and you shouldn't have drunk too much at a party or something? You know, is it appropriate to share that experience? What sort of effect would that have generally on children if you sort of share those misdemeanors?
Yeah, I think it depends on the age of the child and the severity of the misdemeanor. So I think if it's a if your child's gone out and is 17 and has had a hangover or whatever because they've got drunk, you can sympathize with it because you can remember when that happened, and, you know, I think that's fine. Regaling stories of drunken debauchery to your 14-15 year olds, probably not such a good idea.
Yeah. So it's basically a balance between things not being so forbidden that they're seeking the thrill of many activities.
Yeah, and not being a hypocrite about it either.
Yeah,
because, you know, when you were younger, you did this, that and the other, and you know, you've lived to tell the tale, and it's part of growing up and all the rest of it. So I think kids smell hypocrisy a mile off, and they don't respond well to it.
Thankfully, we didn't have Facebook in my day, so there's no record of any of those activities.
I'm sure there's a couple of photos somewhere.
So I think I love the idea of embedding those lessons very early on. If there's people listening whose children may actually have, you know, they've gone underground with their activities, you know, and the parents are finding it very difficult to communicate with their children, maybe perhaps older teenagers, what would your advice be, Amanda?
There are different techniques. I think having shared activities is a good way forward. We've actually just part of the Fundamentally Children is the Good Toy Guide, and we've just got a game that we're testing called Sust, and it's this game where it's a card game, and it promotes conversation, and it just promotes sort of talking about those subjects that you might not talk about normally. And so family games like that, where you can start getting conversations going that aren't a kind of interrogation, they're not a under the microscope, you must do this, you must do that, you know, where were you last night until 11 o'clock. It's not that kind of it's more a kind of understanding
friendly
where
discussion.
Their values
friendly discussion,
absolutely. And I think possibly in those circumstances, if you're really worried that your kids just don't relate to you and they don't think you've got anything in common with them, that would be a good argument for saying, actually, when I was your age, I did some of this, you know, I did something stupid, or I tried this, and, you know, and I do understand why you might be worried about X, Y, and Z. But I think, just trying to keep some shared family activities, whether it's a, you know, a regular...
Yeah, no matter what it is.
Yeah, it doesn't matter what it is,
yeah,
but some family traditions that you can keep going, that kids build into their week, and they understand that that's quality family time.
And the other lovely
really
thing
important.
About that is you're not having a horrible confrontational conversation when the actual event begins to happen, or they want to go somewhere, that you're building that relationship up.
Absolutely. And then they then self-regulate, and that's what you want to happen, is instead of them saying, please, can I go to this party that's completely inappropriate, they go, do you know what, I'm not going to go to that because... And they make their own decisions. And if you can get that before they go off and live independently at university or, you know, wherever, then you've done a really good job.
So we're going to leave it there. I love the word self-regulation. So that's what we're all heading towards and aspiring to, Amanda.
Good luck.
Thanks so much, Dr. Amanda Gummer. Thanks very much.
Radio Maryland.
And you're listening to The Parents Show on Radio Verulam 92.6 FM. Now, continuing our discussion about letting our children go, we thought it might be interesting to get back on one of our previous guests. So hopefully we've got Ian on the phone. Hi, Ian, are you there?
Yes, hello there.
Thanks ever so much for coming on. So, Ian, you're from a quite a unique insurance company, aren't you, called Marmalade?
That's right, yes.
And I don't know if you've had a chance to listen in, or I know you kind of know the theme of our show is trying to support our children as we let them go into that big wide world.
Yeah.
And I feel that that's something your company does quite well with, helping children to learn to drive safely. Would you agree?
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
So, I mean, can you just basically, in case people haven't heard before, because I know, you know, somebody else from your company was on, what is a telematics device, or more commonly known as a black box?
Right, okay. A telematics device literally is a small black box that's fitted to a car. It can't be seen. They're normally fitted behind, say, the dashboard. It's a very simple install, and that device will send a signal through to a company like ourselves, and it's then changed into a scoring system depending on the company, and then that scoring system is sent back to the customer, and it shows how they're driving and how they're performing as a driver and how safe they are.
So why should parents of, you know, 17-year-olds think that this would be something that would give them a little bit of peace of mind, potentially?
Right, OK. Well, from our point of view, the main part of it is really driver behaviour. So a young person who's just passed their test, they, like most young people, they feel they're slightly indestructible. So they're behind a wheel, and what the black box does is just remind them, it's sort of in the back, it's in their mind that there's something there monitoring them. And what we feel is that once they've had 2 to 3 years of telematics monitoring them, then their behaviours will hopefully change when they move away from telematics.
So is it becoming, you know, a more popular sort of tool for parents to buy into now? Because I know when I did it for my daughter, it seemed to be quite a new thing on the market.
Yeah, no, I think so. I think the awareness is certainly getting out there. I mean, the conversations we have now with parents who are fully involved when their children first start to drive, the questions are now far more designed around about curfews and what some companies do, and what our company is just looking at driver behaviour. So I think there's a lot more awareness. It's still not fully out there yet.
Okay.
And I think as more and more of the big companies are coming into the market, that's just going to pick up.
And you have data, don't you, that shows that the children, or the young people, I should say, using the black box actually do end up having... less crashes.
Yes, from Marmalade's point of view, our data shows that the normal accident or claim rate is about 1 in 5 for in their first year. We're about 1 in 20, so we know that we're a lot safer for young drivers. Yeah.
If people are listening and they're interested, obviously we've put your company up on our Facebook page, but does it cost a lot to have one of these black boxes put in your child's
car? No, I think us and most of our competitors, it's included in the price of the insurance. The insurance companies that work with firms like us understand that the risk is much lower with a good telematics device, so they're able to include the cost of the box inside the insurance because they're going to pay out so much less in claims.
And then after, 2 or 3 years, or I don't know how long, do you then take the box out, or does it stay there for forever?
Well, from our point of view, if the customer decides to move away from telematics after 2 or 3 years, they can just have it switched off.
Oh, okay.
And because it's not visible, it stops reporting. If they want it taken out, then no problem. Mm-hmm. There's sometimes a small fee to do that.
Right. Ian from Marmalade, thank you so much. I think it's just so good to get that message out there again. We had a lot of response last time
we
talked about it. So thanks ever so much for
your
time tonight.
Much.
Okay, thank you. Good night.
Neave Solicitors are proud to sponsor The Parent Show. The friendly team at Neave's includes specialists who can guide you through all the legal ups and downs of family life. Visit nevesolicitors.co.uk. Neave Solicitors, your complete legal solution.